21-1954, Procon Analytics v. Spirion. Mr. Bloom, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The claims of the 598 patent are not directed to an abstract idea, and so they are eligible under Section 101. They are directed to a practical application that improves computing and network technology. In particular, the method claims improve conventional vehicles with a location device, and they recite specific steps that result in the location device being reusable and interchangeable between different vehicles, improving the location device itself. Because they don't simply use computers as a tool, but instead improve the tool, they are eligible under this court's precedent. I believe that the district court here erred by overgeneralizing the claims. In fact, the claims are oversimplified all the way to the preamble of managing a vehicle inventory, which this court has repeatedly warned against in cases such as TLI Communications and EnFish. In fact, the TechSec case is a good one to look at, 978 F3D at 1295. There, the claims, according to the defendant, were directed at multiple levels of encryption, but this court criticized that characterization because it ignored the elements of the claims. Particularly, the claims recited the use of a key manager and the use of labeling that was used in determining the encryption. Well, here the district court also ignored elements of the claims, including the recited location device, as well as all the steps that are recited as part of a registration process. The claims don't just computerize inventory management. They aren't just directed at collecting and analyzing information. If we look at the actual limitations and the recited steps of Claim 1, you'll see that they are reciting an improvement to the location device itself, making it reusable and interchangeable. Looking at Claim 1, which is Appendix 49, the very first step is, while the location device is not commutatively coupled with the vehicle, that the location device is associated with the dealer's group of available devices. Next in the steps, the location device is commutatively coupled with the vehicle, and in response, it sends a connection notice. The computer receives that connection notice, and then in response to that receipt by the computer, more steps are performed, including associating the location device identifier with the vehicle, and then disassociating that location device from the dealer's group of available location devices. So this is a registration process. Claim three is then further directed to the opposite, the deregistration process. And these steps allow that location device to be used between, it's a pairing process between the computer and the location device, and it allows the location device to be reusable and interchangeable between different vehicles. And this is actually fairly analogous to the Unilock v. LG case, which is 957 F3D at 1303. In that case, the claims were directed to a Bluetooth-like system where you had a primary station and a secondary station that could be something like a wireless keyboard. The primary station would send an inquiry message, which was acknowledged to be conventional in the art. But what the invention did was add a new data field that was used for pulling the secondary station. And so it communicated this extra data, and yet that was found to be sufficient to make the claims eligible under Section 101, because what that extra data being communicated did was actually improve the technology. It improved the secondary stations by reducing the latency. In the present claims, you have communications going back and forth between the location device and the computer, which also improve the technology by making that location device reusable and interchangeable between different vehicles.
So where is the specific improvement articulated in the specification? In the cases you cited where there was a new packet of data, it reduced the time to transmit. In other cases, like Fish, it reduced the amount of memory needed to store. There were very specific and concrete improvements to the device itself that could be identified and that were articulated in the spec. Where is that for this case?
Well, Your Honor, the specification describes the registration or pairing process at column 15. It starts, in relevant, most relevant part would be around 63 and through the end of that column and into the next column where it describes how the registration process works and, you know, and how that is done. And if you're asking where, you know, where exactly does the specification identify this as being a you know, this registration as being a problem, I think that would be an issue of fact, whether, you know, to the extent they're disputing whether that was actually a problem in the industry, that's something that, you know, could be identified through fact discovery and experts.
Well, I'm having trouble understanding your answer. In all of the cases where we have held that a claim amounted to a technological improvement of the system, it was really clear from the specification such that it couldn't be disputed. The specification alleged a concrete and specific improvement. Where is there anything in the specification that tells us of a specific improvement, like increased speed or decreased memory consumption or something that this invention and some particularly claimed component of it achieved?
Well, I think a person of ordinary skill in the art reading about this registration process and then the deregistration process that is disclosed in the specification would understand that makes it reusable and interchangeable. But I think there's a problem with reversing the burdens here. You know, patents are presumed valid, and so there should be an opportunity to develop through expert testimony and through facts. You know, there is no requirement, you know, at the motion to dismiss stage, motion for judgment on the pleadings, an affirmative defense should only be granted if the complaint actually pleads itself out of court. There's no duty to identify these facts at the pleading stage, particularly where this was a declaratory judgment case where eligibility was not even asserted in that initial declaratory judgment complaint.
But when there's no evidence present in the actual specification that demonstrates a technological improvement, you're saying the court needs to nonetheless assume there is one and therefore would never be able in a Rule 12 case to actually rule on any of these things. So all of the many, many cases that have been decided under Rule 12 on Section 101 to date would be wrongly decided?
No, Your Honor, because I think when you look at cases where they were dismissed at the present stage, there was no improvement or even alleged improvement to the technology. What they did in those cases, it was usually just data being received by a computer and then processed and you know, data being displayed. There's no alleged improvement to the underlying technology itself. You know, and here there is an you know, we have alleged that it improves the location device by making it reusable and interchangeable, and moreover we've also alleged that it improves the conventional computer or conventional vehicles themselves by transforming them into a vehicle that can transfer their location data, which the specification describes the location device as being a unique device. But I think there should be an opportunity for there to be factual discovery to the extent that Procon disputes any of this. That's an issue of fact. I think a Rule 12c motion should only be granted if there's no set of facts that could be proved.
This is Judge Toronto. Can I ask you, turning away from the merits of the 101 question, to your opening argument in your brief, page 21 to 25, about the district court exceeded its authority by invalidating unasserted claims, which is to say claims not on the list in your infringement contentions of the claims that you were asserting to be infringed, and this is all tied to the fact that, as pled, the 101 challenge was merely an affirmative defense and not a counterclaim. In the Procon's 101 motion under 12C, it's explicit in going through every single claim of the patent. in your response, you never say, we object to this in part because the request for 12C judgment is too broad. You never say that that request could only possibly be granted as to the asserted claims. And indeed, I thought at the end of your 12C response, you asked the court to decide that all the claims are not directed to an abstract idea. So why have you not forfeited any objection to the scope of the district court's 101 ruling?
Your Honor, our argument is that because they were not asserted, there's no case or controversy over those claims, which is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction that can neither be waived nor forfeited.
The other side could have filed, had you put it on notice that there was a problem of that sort, could have sought to amend its pleading to add a counterclaim to say what its affirmative defense said, but you didn't give them notice that they had to take that step.
No, Your Honor, because there would be no subject matter jurisdiction to have added that counterclaim.
Well, how do we know that? I thought your only point about subject matter jurisdiction, your only point was that you had merely asserted a subset of the claims. You didn't, as far as I can tell, ever say there's no case or controversy in the sense that PROCON could not possibly have the kind of interest that under MedImmune would give Article III jurisdiction to adjudicate all the claims.
I think under MedImmune and this court's precedent in Strike, it is PROCON's duty to show that substantial controversy at all stages of the case. And here, we've asserted that there was no case or controversy, and so it was actually their burden to establish that jurisdiction, which they failed to do.
Where did you assert that in the district court?
No, we didn't assert that in the district court. We've asserted that on appeal, and subject matter jurisdiction, cannot be waived or forfeited. And so under MedImmune, it was their duty. I mean, here there's no evidence, there's nothing at all that those claims are ever going to be asserted, that there's any factual basis that they could be asserted, and PROCON has not asserted otherwise.
Okay, thank you.
This is Judge Moore. On that same point, didn't they actually file a counterclaim with regard to all of the claims, not limited to the ones that you limited your infringement contentions to, but didn't they put in issue, or not a counterclaim, an original declaratory judgment request with regard to 102, 103, and 112 for all of the patent claims?
Yes, Your Honor. They had a declaratory judgment claim with 102 and 103, not 101, but still it is their burden under MedImmune to establish that there is actually a case or controversy over the unasserted claims. Reasonable apprehension is not the standard anymore, but there's nothing in this case that indicates they had a reasonable apprehension or really any other reason for thinking that there's an actual issue with those unasserted claims.
Well, wouldn't one of the reasons be your opposition to their motion in which you asked the court to declare all the claims valid? Doesn't that give them the impression that you very much think all the claims are still subject to this controversy?
The same could be said for cases like Streck and Fox, but I mean, I think when we responded to the claims, they're in the argument that the claims that we're focused on were claim one as well as some of the dependent claims. And of course, if claim one is found to be eligible, I think that's necessarily going to mean all of the claims are eligible. Unless your honors have any further questions, I'll reserve the small amount of time I have left for rebuttal.
Okay, no problem. Mr. Ogden, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. There's only one technological problem that is discussed in this patent, and that's that programming is hard and it takes time. And none of the claims address that technological problem, nor do they address any other technological problem or provide a technological solution. The only disclosure of location device hardware is the patent's disclosure of the prior art itself, an off-the-shelf location device. And the claims do no more than describe the functionality of that prior art location device. Now, recognizing this problem, Spiron's now trying to characterize the prior art device as something new. But that view is not supported, even in the light most favorable to Spiron. And so I just want to discuss the evidence put forth that shows the conventionality of the location device. So first, we have the statement in the patent. In an exemplary embodiment, a location device may be an off-the-shelf tracking device for a vehicle. For example, for use by an end user, for user-based insurance, for fleet management, for managing driver behavior, and or the like. And that's at Appendix 39 at Column 8, lines 23 to 27. Second, we have the broad construction of location device by the district court as a device that can determine and transmit location information. The reasoning behind that can be found at Appendix 1699 to 1702. And the breadth of what a location device is, as claimed, is important because Spiron has agreed in its opening brief at 48 that prior art integrated devices existed. Those are the exact type of devices that would be captured by the claim language here. Third, the patent explains, and this is at Appendix 48 at columns 26, 19 to 21, that indeed, for the sake of brevity, conventional manufacturing, connection, preparation, and other functional aspects of the system may not be described in detail. And so this is the case for the location device. There is very little detail about the location device because it was available off the shelf. And so there's several pieces of evidence in the specification for the conventionality of the location device. And there's no contradictory evidence. Now, Spiron's counsel noted here that repeatedly said that Spiron had alleged certain improvements. But those allegations are not in the pleadings, and this was a motion for judgment on the pleadings. They are conclusory attorney argument. And as we know from Atrix, a court need not accept as true allegations that contradict matters properly subject to judicial notice or by exhibit, such as the claims and the patent specification. We also know from, for example, CX Loyalty v. Maritz Holdings that conclusory testimony should be given no weight. And in that case, it was dealing with expert testimony. Here we're talking about attorney argument, which again should be given no weight. And so we have the conventionality of the location device. And then the other elements here that were kind of discussed were an improvement to the network itself. Well, the network also is conventional, and there's plenty of evidence for that. The server that may be used here can be any suitable server. For example, a Microsoft SQL server. We can see that at column 9, lines 29 to 45. The networks are conventional. There's discussed it can be radio, cellular, or Bluetooth. That's at column 7, lines 14 to 18. And among those cellular networks, it discusses brands that we're all familiar with, Sprint, T-Mobile, AT&T. That's at column 14, lines 14 to 17. And even for these location devices, for the transmitter element, it can be any suitable transmitter. That's at column 7, lines 12 to 14. And for managing the devices, it names branded software with the trademark symbol, Novatel software, at column 8, lines 10 to 14. And that's the software that can be used to manage and to the extent any other programming would be needed, the location devices. And then finally, one of the things that was hit on was reusability, and is that's being some kind of improvement to the location device. Most of the portion of the claim that's relied on for reusability, which is claim 3, deals with obtaining ownership information and determining if the device is still owned by the dealer. But all of that occurs through conventional data management, and in fact, that the patent explains in the specification that the ownership information can be obtained from a conventional dealer management system, which it terms the DMS, and that's at column 1635 to 17, column 17, line 2. And dealer management system is different than the inventory management system. This is a conventional, already existing system at the dealer, just like you would think about where they maintain their records and that sort of thing. And so all that's happening here is data management. And I think one of the points that Your Honors hit on is very important here. All of the cases that Spirion relies on, I shouldn't say all, but the majority of the cases, and I think it is all, in those, this improvement that was focused on in an oral argument or on an appeal was discussed in the specification. Here, none of these alleged improvements are discussed anywhere in the specification. There's simply no evidence that these are improvements or that these were even problems that existed in the art. And so the first improvement that's discussed is the improvement to conventional vehicles. And so one of the, I believe it was stated, it turns a conventional vehicle into a constantly trackable node on a network. And so I would argue that this is no different than what we saw in the Chamberlain case, where there was a pre-existing movable barrier system, and all that was done was that movable barrier system was given the ability to wirelessly transmit status information. The same is true here. The location device is merely connected to the car to serve as to provide a way to wirelessly transmit status information. And each of the claim limitations we see are only talking about the transmission of fairly generic status information, identifiers, ownership information, battery voltages is one that's discussed. So there is no improvement to the conventional vehicle. The conventional vehicle is operating the same way it always did. All that is happening is a transmission of status information. So then there's this other argument about the reusability that I touched on as an improvement to the location device. But the location device itself is not functioning any differently than it was before. And I want to call up a specific quote from the, Spirion's reply brief. It's at 25, and they say, in response to the coupling, the rest of the method occurs through communications between the device and the computer. And this is Spirion agreeing that this is just data transmission.
Counsel, so, can you please address the jurisdictional issue?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd be happy to. So with regard to subject matter jurisdiction, there's three reasons that the district court had subject matter jurisdiction. First, the pleadings asserted that Claim 1 was representative and was not exhaustive. Second, the preliminary infringement contentions reserved the right to add claims, which was permitted as of right under the scheduling order. And third, and I think this was hit on earlier, the briefing before the district court addressed all the claims. It never mentioned that the district court did not have subject matter jurisdiction. And in fact, a couple of the unasserted claims, Spirion notes in its reply brief at 16, that unasserted claims 7 and 8 were referenced during oral argument before the district court. And so they were being treated by Spirion as if there was a live case or controversy. And to the extent that Your Honors believe that affects the outcome, it is correct that PROCON alleged the invalidity of all the claims, and in doing so, in the pleadings, it was admitted by, in response to that, it was admitted by Spirion that there was a justiciable case or controversy. And so I think that is all of those together are dispositive of the subject matter jurisdiction issue, and the court properly had subject matter jurisdiction at the time.
Counsel, does it matter if you admit there's jurisdiction if there's no subject matter jurisdiction?
Well,
the answer is actually no.
No,
there really isn't a way to say that. On a different question but kind of related thing, you have to have subject matter jurisdiction at all times in a case. Once they have narrowed their infringement contentions, do you still have subject matter jurisdiction over the other claims that are not part of the infringement contention?
Based on the reading of the three cases that we have in front of us, it may be four. What I would say is that until those contentions are final, so long as there is a right to add claims, that that there is still a justiciable case or controversy. And so I believe that that is the case here. The two cases mainly relied on in Fox and Streck, those cases had reached all the way to summary judgment, and either final contentions had been filed or it was specified in the briefing at summary judgment what claims were at issue, and I think it was noted in at least one of those cases that the parties were on clear notice about which claims were at issue.
Well, I mean, don't you think you're on clear notice about which claims are at issue in their infringement contentions? I mean, they expressly say 1 to 3, 5 to 6, 9 to 10, and then doesn't the district court scheduling order pick up on the exact thing?
Well, the district court scheduler, just to comment on that, that came from the patent scheduling conference, at which time we had already completed the initial contentions. I agree that that's what the initial contention said, but because we weren't at final and they expressly on three occasions reserved the right to add claims and indeed were seeking discovery on
these other claims. Where did they reserve the right to add claims?
In their initial infringement contentions, Your Honor.
Right. They say we reserve the right to supplement or alter these disclosures, right?
Sorry, Your Honor, I'm just going to take a second to make sure.
It's on 255 of the appendix, if that helps.
Okay. That's great. Thank you, Your Honor. Go there. Okay. In their footnote, they say they reserve the right to amend these contentions as necessary. They're on Appendix 255, and an amendment certainly encompasses the ability to add claims.
But to amend, wouldn't they have to have asked the court for permission to add claims after this point?
No, because they had, as of right, they had until the final contentions to add that. Under we adopted the Western District of Tennessee's local patent rules, and we had not reached the point of final contentions, so they could have added any claims they wanted.
Have you given us those rules?
No, Your Honor, they were not in the record. We did provide a site, and I don't have it off the top of my head to where they were referenced that was in the record.
If counsel, I don't know if you can address this. You know, my law clerk sitting here says he's read the rules and they absolutely do not say you have a right to add claims as a matter of right. So are you familiar enough to say that's not correct?
They don't expressly say that, but as far as the practice that we've done in the Western District, there's no need to seek leave of court in order to add claims at the final contention stage. So
the rules might not say it, but it's your understanding of practice generally in the district to allow it.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
Can I ask this question? Suppose, just for purposes of this question, that we conclude that all of the asserted claims, as to all the asserted claims, the ineligibility ruling of the district court was correct, but that on this record, there should not have been included any of the unasserted claims. At that point, the case is not over, I think. Is that right? As to even the unasserted claims, because you have pending affirmative claims of your own from, I think, the original DJ action of invalidity under 102, 103, and 112 of all the claims in the patent. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that is correct, that as of now, that is how that would work. We would be surprised, you know, in practical matters, it would be surprising, I think, for Spirion to press the other claims if this court did affirm the finding as to the asserted claims, but they could well do that if that's what they would like to do. And certainly we would continue to press the invalidity of those claims. And I think I just heard my time is up, but I'm happy to answer any other questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Blum, rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to quickly discuss step two. At the pleading stage, it cannot be assumed that the ordered steps within the claims or the location of ICE itself are conventional. The cell spin case is actually helpful in this respect. I mean, there you had technology that was photographs going from a camera to a phone to a website, and the court found that it couldn't be assumed that two-step, two-device structure was conventional. The claims here have a similar two-step, two-device structure when you have vehicle identifier information going from the vehicle to the location device to the computer. In cell spin, the court also found that the fact that you had to establish a paired connection before there were any transmissions cannot be presumed to be conventional. And again, the claims here have the similar registration process before the transmissions. Unless the court has any further questions, I believe my time is up.
Hearing none, I thank both counsel, and this case is taken under submission.
The Honorable Court is adjourned.